Have you ever had to fill out a third-party risk management form? Are you tired of filling out hundreds of questions over and over again? There may be a better answer. I've got a gentleman who's going to be on the show next, Nate Lee. Stick around. You're going to love this one. Hello and welcome to another episode of CISO Tradecraft, the podcast that provides you with the information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. My name is G. Mark Hardy. I'm your host for today, and I have Nate Lee on the call who's going to be talking to us about, well, third-party risk management. Welcome to the show.
G. Mark, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So I understand you're working a startup, and I've had a lot of entrepreneurs on the show in the last few months. So tell me a little bit about what you're working on and maybe what you did before that, and then that leap of faith that you've made to go out and do what you're doing right now.
Sure. I mean, I've been a CISO for the last 10 years and been in security for longer than that. And then a couple of years ago,
right here, looking for it.
Oh, yeah. No, it's okay, it's down here. All right. Back from the camera. Yeah, it's all hidden here.
Yeah, wait long enough. Okay. It'll work its way up.
I switched to doing consulting, though, because I wanted to be helping like other scale-ups. I really like kind of the B2B SaaS space and just generally the work there and the pace and so on and so forth. But then one of the things I realized was a lot of these companies selling to enterprises, one of the big problems they have in the earlier stage, it's less about security because we have a lot of secure defaults. It's easy enough to kind of build things directionally, you know, in a good spot. But when it comes to selling to enterprises, you hit TPRM processes and it just is sort of insane what people go through. I think people feel it on both sides. If you're in an enterprise, which I've been there as well, you're trying to get some tool. It's going to increase your team's productivity or do something for the business. And now you end up in this quagmire of like it takes 2 months to get approved. And then being on the selling side, you're getting hit with all these questions. You're thinking in your head, like this isn't what you should be worried about. Or you know, this isn't telling what you think it is, all of those things. And so started building a company that is focused now on like free questionnaire automation for everyone because I really, really dislike questionnaires. And so how can we make that, you know, democratized and give it to everyone? But then also moving up the chain a little higher to TPRM because this is sort of the root of the problem. Questionnaires end up being like a symptom. So how do we better enable teams to think about third-party risk management? What are they trying to actually solve and how can they get what they need?
Got it. So for the TPRM, third-party risk management, just in case people aren't tracking with the acronyms, I always like to define an acronym before I keep
that
rolling.
It's a smart thing to do.
And in order, it's like writing papers and things like that. I remember that from back in the university days. But yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And if you said that you can get an enterprise customer totally on board in only 2 months. That's amazing. Because what I had found out in the startup world is everybody said, oh, I'm going to go for Fortune 50 or Fortune 100. That's the worst possible thing you can do. Why? Because you're going to be tied up in legal. You're going to be tied up in contracts. You're going to be tied up in negotiation. It's going to take you a year to get your first nickel out of that client. And so as a result, what you want to do is you want to build out your business at perhaps a little bit more modest level. And then when you're ready, we'll go ahead, we'll do the crossing the chasm thing. And then we'll go ahead and make our beachhead, get that one big client. And at that point, you can use FOMO with all the other big clients saying, well, you know, they're using our solution and they're your competition and they're going to get ahead of you if you don't start using it. But that's, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves.
You've got that nailed though.
Yeah, I've been there, done that, got the scars from doing it. And so anyway, as we look at the concept of third-party risk management, where did that come from? I mean, initially, I remember, I mean, way back when I was doing security, you kind of got a feel for the person on the other side. You might have had a standard contract. And then you said, like, okay, get to work. When did we start getting into this whole risk management thing about trying to understand more and more? And then really, is it mostly self-attestation or is there actually some real teeth to these TPRM questionnaires?
I mean, three questions. I think these are two. And I'm totally going to need you to remind me of them after I get sidetracked halfway through. But I think those are really interesting questions because the part about where did this come from probably informs, you know, how did we get here and what do we need to do differently? Because if I think back, I'm guessing a lot of this is sort of an organic type of thing, right? Because it used to be there was no SaaS. You built your own stuff and it all ran internally, or you bought a box of software and nobody really did due diligence on it because you were running it. And then as you started moving things to the cloud, like I remember when Amazon first started offering services, and I think I was working at Target back then, and everybody's like, well, this is dumb. Like, why would we be paying someone else to run our things? And then it became more and more obvious what some of the benefits are. And at the same time, you're buying SaaS now instead of, you know, infrastructure. And so you have these providers who may or may not be as well qualified as you. And people felt they needed to do something. And then over the past decade, as you know, there's been more and more vendor breaches, it ends up being like, well, we have to do something. And questionnaires are sort of like the obvious, like if you were to think of like a maturity level, that's like the obvious place you're going to start. Well, let's start asking them questions. And I think it just is only starting to be where people are realizing that, like, hey, there's got to be a better way. This isn't so helpful because the questionnaires have built up over time. You know, it's got somebody's visual basic macros kind of built into an Excel spreadsheet. It's I don't know what kind of ridiculous stuff, how that still ends up being there. The questions are from the 90s. And so to the other point, I think it's I don't know that they're really having a lot of teeth either. I mean, these aren't contractually binding in any way. No one puts them in the contracts. The way the questions are worded often, to me at least, shows that whoever's asking them doesn't really understand what they're trying to protect against or what the real threats are. Like if you ask, is your data encrypted at rest? In a vacuum, that sounds like a great thing. Like, yes, your data should be encrypted at rest. But if you don't give any more detail than that, there's a million ways I can answer that positively that don't really tell you anything. And at that point, it makes it kind of a waste of time because you're taking attention away from the things that really could matter, that really do move the needle. And if you haven't signed a contract yet, you actually do have the ability to push some of these vendors, especially if you are at a Fortune 50 or a Fortune 500. Like you can push the software vendors to do things to sign your contract, but it's going to be a lot harder to do that if you have 200 questions and like there's all this noise you're trying to sort through. You don't know what actually is meaningful at that point.
Now, did this come from legal? Did it come from GRC? Did it come from contracts? Where do you think all this stuff really got going?
I'm guessing, and I'm really guessing. I have no clue.
And as a guest, I understand that because, but you know, you're doing a business this way. So this is part of your due diligence.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would think it's coming from GRC. And then, you know, as we had SAS 70 and then it moved into SOC 2, you know, you had things where like, well, what are your subservice providers? Who do you depend on? And then, oh, well, we need something from them to show that we, you know, aren't just shoveling off responsibility and carving that out. Like, what have you done about this? And so you had to do something. Often that's getting their SOC 2 questionnaires probably are, you know, a way to standardize that. Although it's really kind of reminds me of the XKCD comic where it's like, oh, now there's 17 new standards. That's really how it is with the questionnaires.
Yeah, I remember getting a questionnaire as a CISO. And there's like two questions that I'm just like, did kind of the Scooby-Doo on here. The first one was, is that, do you use third parties for, you know, like a SaaS provider? So I'm like, yeah, we have Microsoft, we're in the cloud. The second one is, do you make your third party conform to your audit standards and can you produce it? Like, no, Microsoft is not going to jump through my hoops. Hello, McFly, what's going on here? And so, well, I think we all are in violent agreement here, both the two of us, as well as everybody who's listening in, that there's something that has to be a little bit better because at worst, it's a paper exercise or maybe in the best, but at worst, it's a false sense of security. What it is a couple of things. In the federal government, in Department of Defense, we're doing the CMMC, the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification with the three different levels, which originally started out having to get certified at all three. And they said small businesses having to get certified level one was cost prohibitive. So, okay, you can self-attest here, but then two and three, you got to go ahead and get an auditor come in here, dot the I's, cross the T's, and prove that you got all 110 points. For your audit is compared to, for example, a lot of these questionnaires, which you fill them out. Now, it's almost sort of like, well, you don't want to be a perfect score on there because it looks suspicious. So you put a couple no's in there and then off it goes. You never hear back from them again. And
everybody knows the game.
Yeah, and that's the game. So what is good supposed to look like? What is your vision of how we could be doing a better job to, A, qualify vendors to actually say, yeah, we like working with them. But then for our parent organization, the one who's actually hiring this third party, to be able to have a level of confidence that says, yeah, we're not taking on undue risk because we did some amount of due diligence. So what does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to good, I mean, some of this ends up being reframing the question. Because like you said, a lot of people are approaching this as, do we want to do business with this company? And I think even that might be the wrong question, because by the time something comes to security, like the business has decided, no one picks based on security first and then, you know, says, well, the security team approved these options, business, which one do you want to use? I mean, it's going to be the other way around. And so instead of thinking about ourselves as gatekeepers, like do we allow this company in? It's more of, we're going to be working with this company. So what is the leverage that we have? You know, there's going to be outliers where maybe it's running out of British Virgin Islands. It's an ex-felon or something, like, sure, you're not going to approve that. But the vast majority of them, if you talk to TPRM teams, like, they don't really turn down vendors. Like, it's, you're going to pass unless you've done something really, really awful. And so at that point, it's, well, let's start from the assumption that we're going to be using vendor X. What are the points of leverage we have? And if you're about to sign a contract, I mean, I assume people in enterprises know this, but you have a ton of leverage, especially if you're working with software vendors who aren't, you know, one of the big ones. Like, they want your business, and this is where you have the leverage. This is where you can actually make a meaningful dent in the risk that you're taking on here. But to do that, you need to understand, like, what's important. What data are we sending? What integrations are going to be there? What are the configuration options in the software itself? What's missing? You know, what do we care about? Because then you can start thinking through what are the important control gaps that they have that we would actually want to have them resolve. And now if you put that in as like, hey, we'll sign, but you need to fix these three things or commit to doing them over the next 6 months or whatever it might be. Now, you know, we can't say that they're, you know, 20% likely to get breached and now they were, you know, they were 40% before. We, like, those numbers are just impossible. But you can know that if you made them enforce unfishable MFA for all their admin accounts and, you know, whatever else it might be that you find that's important, like, you have in absolute terms made them less likely to be breached. I mean, that's just something we can know. You won't know how much, but that to me is good, because now you've concretely moved the needle forward, and, you know, there's workflow stuff around that. You want to probably check and make sure 6 months later they actually did do what they committed, because a lot of people will sign that and hope you never come back. But to me, that's, you know, being active in managing risk and, you know, following up with your own internal teams. Hey, we bought Snowflake. Probably we didn't need to spend a ton of time evaluating Snowflake security, so I could tell them what they're doing wrong. It's much more about, did we set up our own tenant correctly? So thinking about all of these things, you know, and then the follow-on workflow. So you're thinking about, how do we actively manage risk for these vendors, as opposed to, you know, should we use them or not?
Well, that's a very good point. So we're talking about leverage, and it's not necessarily financial leverage. Like, okay, we're going to squeeze you for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 more percent. Mm-hmm. Although it tends to happen, but it's not because of cybersecurity. Really, what we're talking about is leverage for perhaps a smaller or less disciplined company to meet minimum standards for security. As you said, MFA for admins, unfishable MFA, something like my admittedly YubiKey that I use for my global admin stuff for my clients and things like that. And so the purpose of that is what? It's a pain. Yeah, I know that, but I voluntarily do that simply because it is considered to be a standard of due care. And really what we're coming down to is ensuring that these third parties meet some level of due care. Now, inherent in your argument is the concept of some cut point. That is to say, if you're bringing in a small business, a startup, or something that's not as mature, you're going to want to go ahead and have this and this and this perhaps in the contract and enforceable. But as you said, you can't go to Snowflake, can't go to Microsoft, can't go to Amazon and say, let me audit your stuff. I mean, yeah, you can probably get a SOC 2 and you can read it till the cows come home. But it's at some point in time, you just press the I believe button because they've been around so long.
Yep.
And they're big enough. And so where?
I mean, you could probably learn from their SOC 2 things that you should be adopting really at that point.
Where do you think that cut point is? And then is it going to be pretty much consistent, or is it going to be different based upon your security requirements?
No, and I don't think there's any one thing. And this gets to where TPRM folks really do add value, right? Because they know their business. They know what's valuable. They know the risk tolerance. And that's going to be different for every organization. So if you think about, whatever, a bank is going to be very different than like a retailer. And they're going to be very different than a software company. And even within those sort of buckets, it's going to be very different if you're dealing with, marketing collateral that is going to be public anyway versus PII and sensitive personal data and things like that. So some of it depends on what's involved in the engagement. And even there, I mean, that is where maybe you would deny companies kind of more readily, right? If you have healthcare data and it's just, you're a giant big, United Health Group or something like that, you have millions and millions of personal health records, like you probably aren't going to send that to someone who isn't at least fairly mature. Whereas for something else, where it's generating sort of non-sensitive things, you're not going to care as much. And you're going to have much more leeway to say, this company is going to add a lot of value. Maybe their security program isn't as mature, but we're okay with that because of this. And that's where I think TPRM folks and GRC folks, are really able to help be guides in their own organization.
Okay, so what we have then is really two organizations that should have a mutual goal of a higher standard of security for doing the transaction. Either it exists, either you determine by doing your interviews, your talks, your questionnaire, or just due diligence, you say, yeah, these guys have got their act together and we're good with that. Or they don't have their act together, at which point the small business who is looking at this going, oh, come on, really? Is really benefiting from that, because what's happening is you're getting pulled up to a higher standard of due care. You're getting pulled up to a higher standard of being able to enforce security, which is going to mean less likely that you're going to have a breach, less likely you're going to have something go wrong with your contracts, and increase your survivability. Because as we all know, startups, it's a tough place to be. You're already batting about 100 as a startup founder. And that's just what the average is out there. And of course, we all believe we're going to bat 1,000 and make it happen. But the reality check is that not always. So looking then at the future, we have AI and we have AI enablement. And now what people are doing, they get this 264 questionnaire and they feed it to AI and said, answer this thing for me, make it sound plausible, utilize specific data when possible based upon it. Okay, and then off it goes, and it fills the things out, and now we just have slop in and slop out, and they is that our future? I mean, how do we avoid that and get to something that's a meaningful exchange of security concepts as well as validation of configurations and things?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a real concern, right? Because if you're sending these giant questionnaires out, I mean, understanding the reality of who's on the receiving end of this is they have five other questionnaires that are basically asking the same thing, but slightly shifted around. Like, the only sensible thing for them to do is to try to figure out how to automate that. I mean, clearly automation shouldn't be making stuff up and making things sound plausible, but at the end of the day, I mean, that probably is what a lot of companies are going to be doing. But where I think we need to change the dialogue, and it has to come from the buyers, is instead of just having this, it's a shotgun approach, right? You're just asking everything. And I feel like a lot of that comes from a place of wanting to ask all of this stuff. So if something bad happens, you can say, well, hey, we asked. Like, it really is very CYA, instead of thinking much more about, all of the things we just talked about. And I think there's a real place for AI there. And this is something where we can take, again, all of the knowledge that these GRC folks have, that TPRM people have, but augmenting it, because like a lot of them haven't been engineers. They've never worked in a software company, so they don't necessarily know all the ins and outs of the things that you and I might be able to say. Well, if you ask me this question, I can find six ways to answer it positively that, are going to dance around what an actual concern is. But if you can help augment folks on the other side to ask better questions, like what are the 10 most meaningful questions you could ask company X in the context of this engagement? Why are those important? Make it a dialogue internally so that you're thinking through what is my strategy for how I want to assess this company. Read the SOC 2 report, because like I don't want to read somebody's 100-page SOC 2 report, but I might have a list of things that are really important to me, especially in the context of whatever data I'm sending, And read the SOC 2 report. Where are the gaps? Not like exceptions. I know people always look for exceptions, but what they're forgetting is that a SOC 2 report is just an attestation of, I said I'm doing this. Am I actually doing it? But I might not say I'm doing any sorts of meaningful things, right? Like I could say, well, we keep the just screen doors on the server room because the cooling isn't so great in there and we need it that way to keep the servers cool. The auditor is going to come by and be like, oh, the screen looks good and check off on it. There's no exception. But that clearly is not what you really want, you know, in a data center. So some of this is understanding if I can use AI to maybe read a SOC 2 report, identify what are the gaps that I should really be drilling into. Where are things worded vaguely? Where can I start digging in to understand what where I can most meaningfully reduce that risk? And then again, how do I manage that over time? Like, what do we need to do internally to make this successful? What can I push on them with my leverage I have? How do we do this to in a way that materially moves the needle?
So now you're talking about a process that's starting to make sense. Now you're still going to have a cut point, a second one, where companies say, hey, here's my SOC 2. Well, that's 50 grand, 60, I don't know how much, I haven't tried to price one out lately.
They're not that expensive these days, which maybe is part of the problem because you can imagine what that means.
Yeah, maybe that's what I need to start doing because we've had something we just pushed back and we said, hey, we're just X people and the SOC 2 is a little bit out of range. I go like, yeah, okay, fine, fair enough. But if we say there's a SOC 2, as you had said, start with that. Don't start with the questionnaire. Start with the SOC 2. Be able to go ahead and based upon your GRC, based upon your concerns, et cetera, of where you think this type of information, this type of criticality is going to be placed, then maybe you have your AI tool that's specifically designed. Let it read that 100-page report. Here's your list of things you're concerned about. Here's the type of information. As you had said, identify both the gaps, the differences, and the practices. And then from out of there, you might come up with just half a dozen questions to say, for example, you indicate in your SOC 2 report that you use encryption at rest. However, you don't define what that is. Can you attest to whether or not you're using BitLocker on all of your endpoints? It's a yes or no question, assuming you're Windows and you're not Linux or something like that. That's a little bit more specific. And if I know that everybody's running a BitLocker on their hard drive and somebody loses a laptop, okay, as long as they're not logged in and turned on, I'm pretty comfortable. Yeah, that's going to resist a compromise. And so I say that's an acceptable risk. And so this is where we're getting from there. But it also almost begs the question, at some point of the outcome, you're still going to have all these different ways of looking at it. It seems to me that if there was a NIST Special Pub 800-555, that was all of the standard questions, like a 853, right? 853 is a catalog of over 1,000 controls. How about a catalog of all the right questions to ask, but indexed in a way that you could feed that in there where you go ahead and have an interface up front. What are you concerned about? What type of data are you handling? What are your compliance requirements? Do you have to meet HIPAA? Do you have
exactly.
And then based upon that, it comes out, these are the questions you need to ask. Now from that, we go ahead and say, take your SOC 2 that you get from your prospective vendor, apply this to it, chung, 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 and out comes either, yep, they look good, or you're missing something. And I think I just designed a small business.
I mean, that's really the type of thing that we're trying to build here, right? Is how do you, because that's the stuff there is half busy work, but it half requires like some of the knowledge. But it's something where you would partner with someone in TPRM to do or GRC or whatever. Like, let me understand the specifics of this engagement. How are we going to use this? What data are you going to do? Integrations, all that. And then all of the things you just mentioned. And then the output can be this new questionnaire, which is now custom designed to fill those gaps of things you need to know. And the reason I think it's important to do that instead of kind of the current send them the laundry list and like see what happens, it's really easy to hide things in a laundry list. If you ask 10 very pointed questions like this, you know, do you do these things? Like, people are going to be much less willing to be, you know, sort of give you fluffy answers because they know you're not just scanning through it. It's like, oh, like, there's 10 questions here and they're worded in a way that they very thoroughly want, you know, an answer. Like how you mentioned encryption at rest. It's like, I mean, I don't care about the cloud stuff as much because the threat model there is someone walking out of a data center with a hard drive, probably not super big on my list. But things like, where do you, you know, what workstations do people have? is it encrypted on all workstations? How do you validate that it's encrypted on all workstations so that someone didn't turn it off? Like, whatever it might be. But you can now drill into this one thing that you know is a big risk because, and Ross is really good about this in calling out, like, looking at the Verizon data breach report. Like, what are the most common ways companies get breached? Okay, well, we know that these are the 10 most common ways. How are they addressing those? Where are the gaps? And now you can really drill into those. And if those common ways are all addressed in pretty sound ways, again, you've materially given yourself a good signal that this company is more likely to not lose our data. And if they weren't quite there and you use your leverage to get them there, you can say, well, we actually decreased risk. We actively are managing risk, not just saying yes, no, but we reduced the likelihood of this happening. And sometimes you'll lose. Like, that's fine. It's just like playing poker, right? Like, you make a call, like we're gonna accept this vendor, and sometimes they're gonna get breached. Like, that's okay. That's going to happen. You want to look at it and see if there's things you could have done better. But the goal isn't to make sure no vendors get breached. Like, that's impossible. It's one side to, you know, can you deal with it? Do you have process on responding quickly? But also, did you do what you could to minimize the likelihood of that happening?
Yeah, the little questionnaire, it says, prove that you're immune from 0 days or something like that. It's like, no, it doesn't work that way.
Like, you know what a 0 day is, don't you? That's when I read the questionnaire, yeah. Sometimes I'm just shaking my head.
I know we get that back. And it reminds me, so many, many years ago, I think it was, it had to have been around 1990 or 91, I was interviewing with a company out in San Diego. I had been stationed out in San Diego with the Navy. My ship got its home port shifted to Norfolk, and I said, I'll be right back. Well, they say life is what happens to you when you're making other plans. Well, I was interviewing with this one company, and they had a requirement. They're a cybersecurity business, but this is many years ago. You could not use a computer to do your work. Everything had to be paper and pen and things like that. And I said, What? Well, we don't want to get breached. I said, like, you know, it's 1991. What are you worried about? I mean, you had Norton antivirus blocked both viruses that were out there at the time. And it was just this strange business model where it was almost a paranoia to say, yeah, well, there is one way to avoid risk, and that is to cease the behavior. But typically, we're into
unplug the computers.
Yeah, and bury them and stick them in the ground. But we want to manage risk. We want to manage it to an acceptable level. We want to define what acceptable risk is with management, with somebody who can accept that. Uh-huh. Kind of the best way to do that, if somebody is saying, hey, I want this piece of software, I want this tool, I want this SaaS or whatever, is to ask that individual, VP, director, whomever they are, what is your spending authority? How much can you, I mean, if you're in the company, you're an employee there, I can ask you, I can say, hey, Nate, what's your spending authority? And he said, I can spend $250,000 before I have to kick it up to the next level. I said, okay, then you can accept $250,000 worth of risk, but you can't accept $5 million worth of risk. And that's a mistake. I think a lot of middle managers, and I'll use the word manager deliberately, will do is they will look at something and they'll say, a big opportunity. And they throw all their sensitive data at this thing, not understanding that they're really risking the farm when it's kind of like a Nick Leeson or something like that with Barings Bank, where all of a sudden you take down this 230-year-old company by doing dumb stuff. Their internal controls should reflect the fact that if you're taking on a level of risk with a company, with a vendor, with a product, whatever it happens to be, that the person approving that final purchase should be able to accept the level of risk that's inherent in that new business relationship. And I don't know if we codify that anywhere, but that's an idea I want to make sure that we put out there and as a matter of record here. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I think that's actually a very, very good way to do it. I mean, because what you're risking is, you know, that's going to be spent if something worst case scenario happens. I think the one challenge on that I've run into in the past is, what is that damage and what's the likelihood of it? Because it's really hard for people to kind of settle on one idea. Like, security team usually is like, oh, well, the brand risk and this, and they have some big number. And then the CFO is trying to think about it, and they're like, I don't really believe those numbers. And they kind of, no one spends more time kind of defining it. But I think, to your point, there is something there, right? About how do we make sure that it's material and done in partnership, both with the whoever's making that decision, like, do we agree on the value of this data? If not, let's maybe sort some of that out. And turning it into, like, let's understand the value and let's understand the risk, because if that equation is super off, I mean, then that is something you as a GRC or TBRM person should be pushing back on and kicking it upstairs to someone else, just to at least get visibility on that. Because to your point, I think it's very easy. What I see in some companies is like, oh, well, you know, this isn't, we wouldn't approve this, but if you want to accept the risk, and they give it back to that manager, and like, there's no personal liability for this. Like, it's only upside for them to say yes. They're not going to be held liable for this anyway. So, of course, they say yes. And then this is just more theater, right? Like, all you have now is someone who said yes, who maybe isn't here in 2 years anyway when bad thing happens. And even if they are, like, who cares? It's not going to affect them at all. It's just going to look bad for you. So, you know, thinking through what that looks like and thinking about how do we make this more of a transparent partnership, where people understand that this is just, you know, it's two sides of the equation and we're trying to balance them. And if it's out of balance, we want to make sure there's visibility that this decision is being made as a group and we're making it mindfully, not just like kind of haphazardly, well, you know, Tim or whoever said yes.
And that's a good point. I think also not just the magnitude, but also the probability. So, for example, you know, if your kid wants to go in the kitchen and make some macaroni and cheese, oh, you can't operate the stove, you might burn down the house. Well, what's the probability that if you've got an 11-year-old who's going to make macaroni and cheese, that she's going to burn down the house? Okay, yeah, there's a stove, but you're not doing it with hot grease. You're not doing stupid things like that. And so as a result, although the possibility is there, we have to be realistic about it in terms of how we think about risk.
The much greater risk there is you're going to have a dirty pot of macaroni and cheese half eaten that is now your responsibility to clean.
And you find it in the morning, petrified, in the kitchen when you go down to get your first cup of coffee in the morning.
Exactly.
Okay, we're kind of getting a little bit off topic here, but any thoughts that you have that we didn't cover, things that you think we might want to address as part of this conversation that our audience...
I mean, I think this is great. I mean, I think, and we see this with GRC, right? And moving to GRC engineering is the hot thing. I think we're going to be seeing a similar sort of thing with TPRM and having them be much more engaged and involved in active risk managing. As opposed to in the past where it's been, we need to have somebody here who checks the box and make sure things happened and, you know, that someone looked at this and got the questionnaire back. Like, I think especially with AI and AI tools, like you were mentioning, like there's a entirely new way we can think about this problem. And there's a way that we can do it where it enables TPRM folks to be actually working closely with the business and kind of sharing the insights and making a decision together as part of procurement, not just being a gatekeeper who says yes and no. And I mean, I think for people that are in TPRM or GRC, it really is worth taking the time of like, how can I use AI or whatever it is, tools like this to sort of fill the gaps? What pieces can I use where maybe I don't have the skills or the strength? How can I kind of augment myself with this and use this so that we move from where we're at now to where I think we should be? You know, again, being much more actively involved and being a partner to the rest of the business.
Well, got it. This sounds great. So, Nate, if somebody wanted to get in touch with you because they thought your ideas were interesting or they want to learn a little bit more about what you're doing with your startup, what's the best way to do so?
They can reach me at nate@trustmind.com. And yeah, feel free. Definitely. I would love to chat about the topic because clearly I'm very excited talking about all of this. And we'll be launching in a couple of weeks. So if people do have questionnaires that they would like to have done for free, then they should definitely ping me.
Trustmind.com. Okay, that sounds like a great resource, and hopefully people will be able to take advantage of that. So I thank you very much, Nate, for being part of CISO Tradecraft. For our audience out there, hopefully you found this valuable, and if so, go ahead and make sure you're following us either on LinkedIn, if you're not doing so already, or on YouTube or your favorite podcast channel. Don't forget we have a Substack newsletter, and we also have a steady output of information that could be useful to you during your work week that you get from our LinkedIn feeds. This has been Nate Lee. This is G. Mark Hardy, your host. This has been a fascinating discussion on third-party risk management. So I thank you for your attention and for participating in CISO Tradecraft. And until next time, stay safe out there.